In his new book, Ryan Bird says American religion has undergone this massive sorting process over the last 40 years. As evangelical churches became more politically conservative, a lot of moderate and liberal Christians lost their taste for it and just stopped going. Burge is a political scientist. He's a data analyst of American religion, but he's also a former minister, and he's seen this phenomenon firsthand. A few years ago, he was the pastor at First Baptist Church in Mount Vernon, Illinois, and he noticed the congregation had started to slowly shrink. He says he would find himself counting heads during the service, which he admitted is never a good look.
You know, I was sitting in the front in this chair next to the pulpit and looking out at the congregation, and there were a lot more empty seats than there were full seats. You know, I started bouncing my eyes around the congregation thinking, okay, there's this person here and this person here, but that person, they moved away, or that person's in the nursing home, or I did her funeral 2 weeks ago, so she's not going to be back. And, you know, started getting to the actual numbers of the whole thing, and I realized, man, this might be the first Sunday in the history of First Baptist Church in Mount Vernon, Illinois, where we had single digits in attendance on that Sunday. I knew that, like, sort of once we crossed that threshold, there was no going back. And, you know, I thought that if I just preached really well, I could be sort of like a John the Baptist character from the Bible, where people would come from far and wide out to the desert to watch this crazy person proclaim the coming of the day of the Lord and all these things. And I thought, well, if I did the same thing, then I can grow this church. But what I realized really quickly was, I don't care how good you preach. You know, I don't care how orthodox you are, how fervent you are, how prepared you are. If people walk into your church and they're in their 20s or 30s and see a whole bunch of people in their 70s and 80s, it doesn't matter how good the sermon is or how charismatic you are, how friendly you are. People want to be around people like them in terms of age, demographics, and everything else. And when I took over the church, we only had 50 people. I mean, and they were all 60s, 70s, and 80s years old, and I was 23. Like, I don't care how good I was going to preach. So this is sort of the end of the road for what First Baptist was and what was going to be. If you've grown up a church kid, you can't really imagine a life where you're not a church kid. It's just part of your identity, like being tall or short, sort of like one of the building blocks that makes up your personality. And I've been a church kid my whole life. Went to church probably 3 times a week throughout my teenage years. Went to a college where I went to a religious service 5 times a week. I was a youth pastor at the age of 20. So I basically had to go to church my entire life. I mean, that's all I knew. And when all that sort of ground under your feet, which has been so stable and so steady for every single day of your entire life, begins to give way, I think it opens up for you this sense of what I knew was true and what I built my life on might not be as secure as I thought it was. And it's hard. Like, I like routine. I like predictability. And not having that predictability really sort of put me in an existential crisis. Like, why am I still going to church? Do I still want to go to church? What would it feel like to not be? Because you got to understand, I could probably count on one hand the number of church services I went to in the last 20 years where I was not the one giving the sermon. So, you know, what would it feel like to be in the pew, not in the pulpit? Could I stand doing that? Would I like doing that? So it just brought up all these question marks and uncertainties in my life, and I was sort of at a crossroads. And also having it midlife, too, to be fair. I was 42. So, I mean, that's kind of a classic midlife crisis age as well. So it was like all these things sort of falling in on me at one time. And it was really, a really difficult time. One of the most difficult times of my life. I think the reason I do what I do is to try to explain my life and my experience, and also to bring other people into that to say what happened to me has actually happened to thousands and tens of thousands of pastors and churches across America. So, you know, I think in many ways, it's like my church was a microcosm of what was happening in the larger sweep of America. And that sort of unfolded slowly, you know, over a period of probably 5 to 7 years. But it just took a while for me to sort of get all the pieces in place to write the book that needed to be written, using the evidence I needed to have and making the argument I needed to have and being the place in my career where I could make that argument. So, yeah, this is a slow burn. And I wrote the book because I thought I was the only person who could write that book. You know, bringing my personal experience in and my academic background together, not many people can do both those things just because of, you know, the benefit of my background. So that's how the Vanishing Church came about.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For decades, American churches were some of the few places where people who disagreed politically still sat next to each other. Wherever they were on the spectrum, they sang the same hymns, they shared potlucks, they raised their kids together. But Ryan Burge says that world has largely disappeared. And he says what we've lost isn't just religious participation. It's a whole network of social connections and civic habits and places where people learned how to live alongside those who didn't agree with them. Ryan Burge is with us for the hour. He's a professor of practice at Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University. And his book is called The Vanishing Church. And we began with the basics. Why do people go to church at all?
This might be the hardest question of all, I think.
Yeah.
Because, again, I've been a church kid my entire life. And I was just talking to someone like last week about the problem that church people have in trying to conceptualize how non-church-going people think about church. Because we can only think about it with our own background, which is like, it's so important, and you need it for your salvation and community and all the things that you're taught and, you know, sort of like inculcated with when you're growing up. If you don't grow up in church, the thing is, like, church people think about church all the time, and non-church people don't think about it that much at all.
Right.
And I think that's something I have a hard time squaring with people who ask me questions all the time. Because, like, I probably spent more time than almost anyone on earth asking people questions about why they stopped going to church and what would bring them back. And I feel like sometimes I'm trying to put smoke in a box, you know, trying to, like, make sense out of senselessness. Because they don't have a sort of coherent, consistent, thoughtful reason for why they go or why they might not go. It's just, for many of them, it's routine, it's habit, it's what they do on Sunday morning. And for many of them who stopped going, it's like, what's the big deal, man? I just stopped going to church. It really didn't change my life, or better or worse, and I stopped going, and my life really didn't change for better or worse. So, you know, that's why I don't go anymore. So I think it's a problem where the people who ask the question are very deeply involved and invested and thoughtful about it. They're asking people the question who don't have those investments and don't really care. It's not that deep, bro, is that what I had one guy tell me one time when I was asking why he stopped going to church. And I thought, you know what? That's probably a good title for a book at some point. It's not that deep, bro. People just stop going. And so my job is to try to, like, put parameters and boxes and categories around that. Yeah. And I'm not sure that's actually fair to the people who aren't going to church that much.
Well, I want to ask you about what it was that you always liked about going to church, because you described the American First Baptist Church as kind of the perfect fit for someone like you. And we'll talk about where that particular church fits in the categories you explore in the book in a second. But talk a little bit about when you're looking at those dwindling attendance numbers. You said, as far as that goes, the attendance numbers that, you know, in that sense, you describe yourself as kind of an abject failure. But you say you loved these churches for a particular reason. So talk a little bit about what it was. You say there was this faith that was always questioning, that it welcomed the doubters, that it appealed to something that you learned in college. Like, the world wasn't just this binary. It was more gray, that pastors weren't there to tell you how to think. This was something else. So this is a very particular type of church, and it might sound strange for some people from the outside. Talk about that part that appealed to you.
Yeah, I think when I wrote the book, I hope there was a lot of people who read it who go, man, I sort of think about faith like that guy thinks about faith.
Yeah.
And you know, you figure being a church kid who goes to church all the time would have this very sort of like certain deep abiding faith. And the answer for me is I've never had that. And I've always felt like I was less than because of that. And I think the problem is that those kind of people feel like every church, if you walk in and don't believe all of it, they're going to kick you out for not being a true believer. And the reality is that there are so many churches in America where if you walked in and said, I believe 5% of it, they'd be like, that's 3% more than a lot of us. You know, like, we're just happy to have you. And I think that's the kind of church I always sought out, will always seek out, and believe that actually has a really important role in the American religious landscape, because I actually do believe that most Americans are much more in the mushy middle of belief than they are on the I don't believe at all or I'm certain that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. And there's got to be a place. There's got to be lots of places for people on that sort of doubt spectrum. And that's the kind of church I wanted to cultivate. That's the church I want to attend. And I think those are the kind of churches that actually would, you know, that the America needs the most in many ways.
But those are the churches that are dying. I mean, you say, for example, because this fits in that sort of category of these mainline moderate faith traditions, that if current trends continue, they're going to be mostly extinct in 20 to 30 years.
Yeah.
Say something about that, because that's the trajectory. I mean, you say right now you can find these places, but in 20 years you actually believe we may not be able to find them.
Oh, and in many places, many communities in America, you won't be able to.
Yeah.
You know, many smaller towns. My county is 40,000 people. Had 40,000 people, you know, 2020 in the census, and I had 40,000 people in 1950 in the census. So we haven't grown. You know, as America's like tripled in size, we're basically the same size. In my county, I think there are four mainline churches left total, and three of the four are less than 30 people on Sunday morning. I go to the only large-ish mainline church in a county of 40,000, and it probably has 100 to 125 on a good Sunday, which feels huge for a guy who comes from a church from 8 to 10 people. It's like, wow, look at all these people. But, you know, that's the thing is that church might be the last mainline church in the entire county. And I'm sure there are churches in America and counties in America where they're not that small, maybe 10, 20, 30,000 people that don't have a single mainline church. They might only have a bunch of evangelical churches and a Catholic church. That's really the only options they have. And I think that what's shocking for a lot of people who come from this from the outside is the mainline used to dominate American life. That was Episcopalians, Methodists, Presbyterians, Lutherans. I mean, these were kind of churches where half of Americans were members in 1958. And today it's 8%, going quickly down to 5%. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are the kind of churches that a lot of people who had doubt-filled belief, who struggle with clarity and certainty, were looking for something. And now the future is going to look like a place where if you don't believe 100% all these things that are true, there's really no place for you. And I think that's going to leave a lot of people spiritually starving, you know, because they want to express their spirituality in whatever meager, mild way they want to express it. But they have no way to do that because the option is certainty, and they will not embrace certainty. So instead, what they're going to do is stay home on Sunday morning. And the world is going to be worse for that. I think they're going to be worse for that. I think it's just it's a bad outcome for everyone, American society, the church, and them individually.
How much of this is – I don't want to oversimplify it, but we have to bring political partisanship into the story because it's clearly a large part of this. Mm-hmm. And let's start there. Like you say the data is really clear. Democrats have become more liberal. Republicans are heading further and further to the right. This is just an empirical reality. It's not a perception. Mm-hmm. How important is that dynamic in the story about faith traditions?
Oh, I think it's sort of the untold story of what's happened in that. You know, it used to be if you were a Christian, you could vote for a Democrat or Republican. Wouldn't make any difference, really. I mean, you go back and look in – I mean, not that far long ago. I mean, my first election I voted in was 2000, Bush v. Gore.
Yeah.
And that was a 51-48 election in my county, my little county, Marion County, Illinois, where I was born and raised. 51 for Bush and 48 for Gore. Very close. I mean, about as close as you get. And now that same county is about 75% for Trump. And that happened in the span of, you know, 15, 20 years. You know, rural America used to be a place where Democrats and Republicans sat side by side in churches, sat side by side. Even the Southern Baptist Church I grew up in, there were Democrats, you know, not many of them, but there were Democrats. It wasn't like overwhelmingly, you know, Republican, especially not MAGA Republican, but now it certainly is. And I think the problem, though, is that now the Democratic Party seems like I don't understand why the Democratic Party has I don't know if it's been taken over by the sort of like the consultant class and the donor class who are very liberal, sort of far out of step with the average American. Republicans have done the same thing too, by the way, just the other direction. But now the party sort of postured themselves like they can't have moderate, nuanced, thoughtful positions. It has to be black and white, yes or no. You know, either completely for this thing or completely against this thing. And I just don't fully understand why they're doing that, because the Democratic Party has sustained unbelievable losses in most parts of America because of the positions that they're taking. And the problem is the mainline has been stuck because By the way, these mainline churches that are described in the literature is very liberal. That's what all evangelicals say. These liberal Episcopalians and liberal Lutherans and all these kind of funk. What's interesting is 60% of United Methodists voted for Donald Trump in 2024. A majority of evangelical Lutherans, a majority of Presbyterian Church USA voted for Donald Trump. Mainline Protestants have been more Republican than Democrat the last 50 years. The empirical data on this is incontrovertible. And yet, because they're not as conservative as evangelicals, especially white evangelicals, they're seen as liberal. And I think that sort of label they've been laid on them. They're not atheists. They're not agnostics, right, in terms of their political ideology. But, you know, evangelicals have been incredibly effective at saying, if you're one click to our left, you might as well be a socialist. And I think that's where a lot of mainline Protestants have been sort of pegged into this hole where they're so liberal, when actually the values that a lot of mainline churches, you know, argue for, like pluralism and tolerance and respect and openness, these are values that the average American actually has. But unfortunately, the average American doesn't know the mainline churches actually hold those values. They think instead the mainline churches are all about, you know, Black Lives Matter and transgender rights and all these other leftist political issues, when actually that person in the pew is sort of sensible, sort of moderate, sort of middle of the road, seeking compromise. We need more people like that in America, and that's who the mainline used to cultivate, and those churches are basically empty now. So now we're stuck with people on the far left and far right who are not compromisers and actually are incentivized to not compromise. And that's what's put us in the state that we're in right now.
Ryan Burge, he's a professor of practice at the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University. His book is called The Vanishing Church: How the Hollowing Out of Moderate Congregations is Hurting Democracy, Faith, and Us. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ryan Burge has spent years tracking the numbers behind America's religious decline. But in his new book, he argues this isn't about people losing faith. He says it's the political divide that's changing the nature of church life. Burge says there was a time when American congregations were politically mixed, when moderate religious communities helped hold together the country's civic life. But now, as churches grow more ideologically homogenous, people feel they no longer belong anywhere. Burge's book is called The Vanishing Church. So what has happened, work through in the book, is that the same kind of thing that's going on with political polarization is happening in the churches, that people are sorting themselves, I guess, ideologically. And so churchgoers are far less likely today, you say, to worship alongside people who voted differently than they – like, I'm trying to imagine what it was like back in the day after the sermon, and you go in the basement and you have, you know, potluck and a cup of coffee, and not everyone agreed, not everyone was on the same page. It was a different kind of sense, and maybe I'm over-sentimentalizing it or romanticizing it, but it is – at least this is one of the points you're making in the book, is it's harder to find someone who doesn't agree with you politically in America's churches these days.
And that story you just told is the delightful one in my mind. Like, some of the best memories I had as a kid was going to Sunday school, 9:30, going to church at 10:30, and 11:30 we let out, and we walked down the hallway, and the fellowship hall was full of food.
Yeah.
And I had some great conversations looking back, you know, sitting around the table with people that I didn't really have a chance to talk to sometimes. And I think those are the kind of moments, those sort of informal third space moments when real life happened and, you know, connections were made and friendships were made and discussions were had. And I don't know, like, looking back over, let's say, the last 2 or 3 months in my life, how many times I've had opportunities like that to debate with people from different political backgrounds and have a spirited yet civil conversation with them about the topics of the day and how we feel about the topics of the day without someone getting mad. I think we've gotten to the point now where it's like people hold these views so strongly in their heads because they've never had their views challenged in sort of an open, you know, dialogue between two different parties and two different. And when you go to church with people, there's something amazing that happens, is where you are much more open with those people and willing to hear their side than if you just, like, sort of met someone at a dinner party, or, you know, you had one or two casual conversations, because you know that person. You know, you've known them for 5, 10, 15 years, their background, their family, what they struggle with. You've heard them talk in Bible study. I think those are the kind of relationships, maybe not not friendships, like as in you go out to dinner together, but you are willing to be open with other people. We have so few of those in our lives. And churches were an amazing place to have a lot of those across the demographic divide. That's what the church was at its very best, was the greatest mixing place we had in American society. And I don't think we'll ever be able to replicate that anywhere else in American society if these church doors close.
So what does this all mean? What are the implications about it? Because one of the cases you make in the book is that the stakes are higher than just the decline of religion. You say the decline of the church is a problem for all of us. Explain how so.
Yeah, when I pitched the book, I mean, my editor was very clear. She said, Ryan, you know, there's obviously, you know, it's a book about church closure and how bad that is for Christianity, but you need to write a book about how if this continues down the path we're going down, it's going to be bad for all of us. And as I was writing the book, we had a situation where there was not a Speaker of the House for a couple weeks. Kevin McCarthy was removed and the members of the House couldn't find a suitable replacement, I guess, for, you know, over 2 weeks. We didn't have a functioning Congress for 2 weeks. And obviously, we were lucky in that we, you know, some sort of international crisis didn't happen or some financial crisis didn't befall us. But imagine what would happen if we did have one of those things. And the reason that happened was because there were some hardliners in the Republican Party who said, I'm unwilling to compromise on anything, and I'd rather shut the government down than not get my way. And what I would say to that in response, and I feel this as much as I feel anything in the entire world, is if you think the right position is to stand on principle alone and never bend or never break, what you're going to end up doing is destroying American democracy. Because American democracy is predicated at its very core on compromise. You've got to get 51% of voters to go on your side or 51% of members of Congress to vote in one direction to get anything done. If you choose to not move on those issues, and if enough members of Congress choose to be uncompromising, what you have is gridlock and you have nothing done. And what happens is the country suffers and American democracy largely fails. And here's the implication of that. If American democracy fails, it will obviously hurt all Americans and people living in the United States for a myriad of reasons. But think about all the things America does just to stabilize the rest of the world. I mean, one of the reasons the world has gone through this long period of peace is because America has stood up and said, we will, in large part, good or bad, be the world's policeman. And so that's kept a lot of this nonsense from happening the last 50 years. So if we retreat, that's going to lead to all sorts of knock-on effects for people all over the world. And I really do believe that uncompromising members of the United States, population or Congress, could actually lead to the suffering of tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people all over the United States and all over the world. And is that worth it? I would think as a Christian, as a person of faith, I would think that's not worth it at all. Whatever we can do to reduce suffering is what we should do. And anything we make, any principled stand we take that leads to large-scale suffering is not a principle I want to stand on. And I think that's the problem we're facing right now is people are being incentivized to not change their minds on things, and they're actually reveling in the fact they're shutting the government down, which is the exact – to me, that's an absolute failure, and yet somehow it's been spun as a success in this country, and I'm just totally befuddled by that idea.
A good part of the book is what you see is this kind of diagnosis. It's a look at the religious landscape over the last 50 years, and you go through, you know, mainline faiths and Catholics and – evangelicals. You start with evangelicals, actually. So let me ask you about that. One really important point you make is that evangelicals in the pews are more, this is how you put it, theologically unified than ever before. Explain what you mean, because I think this gets to the sort of the, it seems like there's this idea in the book that you go back and forth with that this idea of the Bible being a literal thing, a literal belief in some of these stories in the Bible, you know, views about the Bible being the word of God to be taken literally versus, you know, the Bible is a book of fables and stories that you can learn from, just in the importance of it being like the Ark had to have been a real thing or a story. And I'm wondering that idea of believing literally, where that fits in the larger picture here, because it seems like as you sort of reduce down the people to their belief systems, they're going to become more literal in their belief. There's going to be less room for nuance.
Yeah, no, this is something that people struggle with who don't think in sort of this literalistic mindset. And if you come from a different perspective or a different faith background, and you hear an evangelical say, no, the Bible says that God created the world in a literal 6 days. Yeah. We can go on and on, but Moses, you know, the Red Sea and all these things. People look at that with like the air of like, that is the most ridiculous thing ever. How can you actually believe those things? And what you've got to understand is for evangelicalism, they've built their faith on the idea that the Bible is not just like figuratively true, it actually happened, like word for word, because if you question something like a six-day creation or the crossing of the Red Sea, that sort of kicks the door open to questioning the Bible, and that will lead down the slippery slope of questioning more things about the Bible, including the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And if you question the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, then you are essentially no longer a Christian in their understanding of Orthodox Christianity. So for them, it's better to leave the box closed, right? Leave the door closed, because any crack in that door leads to nothing but bad things. And I think that mentality, evangelicals believe in their heart of hearts to be true, but other people look at that and go, I don't see how those things logically follow from one another. You can believe this thing and not believe that thing. I really do think it's a difference in mindset. That, you know, there's this group we talked about, this group of certain people who just know that these things are true in their bones and will never be convinced otherwise. And then a whole bunch of other people look at those people and go, gosh, I wish I could have such a clear, you know, consistent black and white view of the world. But for whatever reason, their brains do not allow them or incline them to a type of belief like that. And I think that's where the conflict happens. Is like, I'll give you a good example, abortion. Yeah. A lot of Americans, especially secular Americans, think that evangelicals are sort of like cosplaying when they talk about abortion. Like, they really don't believe what they're saying about abortion. They really just want to control women's bodies or something like that. When in reality, I know lots and lots of evangelicals who literally believe in the core of who they are that when a sperm meets an egg, that creates a human life. And if you have an abortion, you are doing the equivalent of walking into someone on the street, putting a gun to their head, and pulling the trigger. And I think a lot of people do not fully understand that other mentality, and therefore these arguments sort of fall flat because one side wants to ridicule the other side for something they feel is so self-evident. And I don't know how we get around that, to be honest with you, except for a lot of people in the middle who have sort of more shades of gray on these discussions step in and say, I know how you feel and I know how you feel, but we've got to find a middle road on these things. And that's how we govern.
Well, it's not just let's find a middle ground. I think one of the main arguments you make in the book is there already is one. Mm-hmm. There is a view that America is far more polarized than it might actually be. And we can come back to the question of abortion, and we can come back to the literal belief in the Bible here in a moment, because I think you make the case that there's a lot more nuanced thinking about those issues among the religious than people may think. Mm-hmm. But let's shift to the mainline Protestant faith that you as a section. And you kind of present these churches as sort of functioning as a kind of civic middle. These were places where Democrats and Republicans and liberals and conservatives, you know, existed together in the same institution. What did mainline Protestantism provide to American life that you're worried about that's going away? Like, what was that about in mainline Protestant churches?
Yeah, I'll give you a great example. So, you know, John Rockefeller, richest man who ever lived in the United States, he was an American Baptist, and you know, near the end of his life, he hated going out, and so he only went out to go to work and go to church. That was really the only times he left his house. And one time he was asked, "Why do you take all the effort to go to church, to fight the crowds and do all the press and the PR and the security and all those things?" And he said, "Because it's my only chance to talk to a plumber or a blacksmith." And I thought that was so incredibly telling, right? It's like that's what the main line has always been. It's like billionaires and blacksmiths sitting side by side on Sunday morning. It was sort of the great meeting place of rich and poor and young and old and more liberal and more conservative. And, you know, in some ways it was a social club, which I think is actually one of the reasons the main lines, you know, failed so spectacularly, is because it was a social club, but its best version was also a social club, you know, where it became a way to see and be seen and build relationships and create friendships and find new jobs and build connections and network and all these things. Like, the value of faith is not just a vertical orientation to God, which is obviously salvation through Jesus Christ is important to me as a Christian, but also the sort of the horizontal orientation. That's what the mainline was always really good at, is that horizontal orientation where you mixed and matched and were different people. And by the way, in the 1950s, if you go back and look, when people go, oh, I wish we could go back to the religiosity of the 1950s. The religiosity of the 1950s was not like Southern Baptist evangelicalism. It was actually sort of polite Methodism and Episcopalians. They were the ones running the show. They had huge power, cultural power, political power, economic power in American society, because their churches were full and they had, you know, huge endowment funds and all these things. So like those are the kind of like bread and butter churches that sort of like go back to like Norman Rockwell America, idyllic America. Those are the kind of churches that were full during those errors that we look back on as sort of like the peak of American religiosity.
We're in Utah, so I want to ask about Mormonism. A lot of the book, of course, is about the collapse of these moderate, mixed, low-pressure religious spaces, you know, places where people with different, you know, politics or different levels of certainty could belong together. But Mormonism is interesting in the sense that it's kind of different than that. It's a high-demand faith. It has a high identity, culture, strong community expectations, strong social cohesion. So I don't know if you've thought that much about it or written that much about it, but is Mormonism an outlier in this story, or where does it fit anyway?
Yeah, Latter-day Saints are an interesting group because it's like, I think sociologically, I think it's very fair to put them in the same general category as evangelicals.
Yeah.
I mean, they place a very high emphasis on their scriptural texts. Obviously, they have very high community standards, you know, about how they act and how they look and how they behave and all those things that evangelicals also do. But, you know, I think the problem that a lot of people have is they think they lump evangelicals and Latter-day Saints together into the same category, which is true-ish, but there's actually some fundamental differences about Latter-day Saints that I think people need to be aware of. And I'll give you a good example. If we ask people, do you think that increasing religious diversity makes the country better or worse, has no change, a majority of evangelicals say it's for a change for the worse. Same thing about racial diversity. If you ask Latter-day Saints about those questions, they do not answer the same way. They're actually fine with both racial diversity and religious diversity. And I think the reason is because they see themselves as a minoritized faith, as a small sliver of the American population, as opposed to being the sort of dominant religious tradition in the American population. So I think in some ways, like Latter-day Saints, that the humility that comes from being incredibly persecuted in their early years, having to flee to the West to get away from all these other Christians, and realizing that all the factors that led to their persecution and their murders could also lead to someone else's murders if they had the same mentality toward other faith groups. So I think in some ways, Latter-day Saints are actually a sort of, from that perspective, a better version than what evangelicalism is, because evangelicalism tries to sort of like lord over and like sort of force its agenda upon people. And LDS have no illusions about that, right? They're much more focused on just trying to be good people. And by the way, Latter-day Saints are probably some of the best people in America when it comes to religious pluralism and like organizing events from people from all faith backgrounds. You would never see evangelicals do that. And yet all the time, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is having events where Hindus and Buddhists and Jews and Muslims and Christians and LDS all sit side by side and talk about their differences and what they hold in common. So actually, I think in many ways, I'm hopeful, at least in that regard, for what the church has been doing in Utah and across the world.
Ryan Burge, we're talking about his new book. It's called The Vanishing Church, How the Hollowing Out of Moderate Congregations is Hurting Democracy, Faith, and Us. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the political scientist Ryan Burge. We're talking about his new book where he documents what he says is the disappearance of America's religious middle. The book is called The Vanishing Church. I wanted to ask you about one part of the book, you shifted this kind of autopsy of why all of this happened. And one of the ideas here that you introduce is what you call the Great Reversal. Could you sort of take us through what happens? It's kind of the flip. It's the 1990s that's kind of a hinge point.
There's a concept in the Gospel of Luke called the Great Reversal. It's the idea that Jesus keeps saying this phrase over and over again, which is the last shall be first and the first shall be last in the kingdom of heaven, right? It's the idea that sort of like the outcasts and the weirdos and the lepers and the people who are disordered in this world will sort of have a better station in life in the world to come. Well, if you look at the data, what the data says is that the American church over the last couple of decades has basically become the opposite of the Great Reversal, and that the people that are most likely to go to church this Sunday are people who are married with children, and they have good incomes, meaning $60,000 to $100,000 a year, and they have college degrees. It's basically become a hospital for the not sick, for the healthy to go to. So actually the church has become much more economically and socioeconomically homogenous today than it's been at any point in the last 50 years, which is something we don't talk about a whole lot. And the knock-on effects, the implications of that are sort of wide-reaching, and we've only begun to understand what they're doing to American society.
So you raise this question in the book where you sort of challenge the idea that we're actually as divided as people think. Are we actually polarized is the question. Mm-hmm. And here's what you say. You say in the book that if you look at the graphs and you look at the charts, it seems like, yes, of course we are. But this is where you complicate the answer. You mentioned how there were these two different camps that were formed around the issue. And I wanted you to sort of explain this to us. On one hand was this argument that this polarization, this division was the fault of the elites. And then there's this other side that says, no, it wasn't the elites. It was the rank and file. Would you just sort of walk us through this part of the story?
Yeah, this is where it gets like way into the weeds of like political science. When I was in grad school, like we debated this ad nauseum, it felt like, was where's the polarization actually happening? Is it happening at the elite level or is it happening at the rank and file level, you know, the average American? And, you know, in those days, the answer was probably it was just happening at the elite level. So, you know, like members of Congress, talking heads on, you know, cable news, places like that were very polarized. And then they would sort of spew that polarization down to the masses. And the masses were sort of rejecting a lot of it, not really polarizing as much. But now there is some data that says that the masses are actually polarizing pretty clearly. But I think the problem, though, is, and this is what plagues this kind of work, is the loudest voices in the room do not equate the largest voices, the largest voting blocks in the room. And, you know, if you look at the distribution of Americans, it looks like a normal distribution when it comes to politics. Yes, there are, you know, if we were on a scale from 1 to 10, there are some 1s and 2s and 9s and 10s. Yeah, but they probably make up, at best, 15% of America. Most of us really cluster in the 4, 5s and 6s. And yet those voices are boring. You know, those people don't get amplified on social media. That's, I think, the biggest problem is social media caters to extremes. It wants people to say nutty, unhinged things because that'll start a conversation and get retweets and shares and all the activity that these social media companies want to have. When in reality, most people would look at that opinion and go, it actually warps them, by the way, because they're going, man, that thing has 1,000 retweets. I thought that was a crazy opinion, but it must be pretty mainstream. 1,000 people retweeted it. So it actually kind of warps our perception of what normal is. I think like one of my superpowers is I know what normal is because I look at polling data all day. Unfortunately, the average person doesn't have that purview, so they don't know what normal is. So I think part of my job is to like help reorient people toward normal and let fringe beliefs be called fringe beliefs, because honestly, a lot of people on social media hold some pretty fringe beliefs that I'm not saying they don't have the right to express them, but I don't think they have the right to sort of like impose them upon tens of millions of people in a way that distorts what reality actually is.
I thought it was interesting the way this plays out in the issue of abortion, because you mentioned this study that was published by the University of Notre Dame about how Americans understand abortion. And there was more nuance there, I think, than people think. More people feeling like they didn't want to be judged, or they didn't want themselves to feel too judgy, that they kind of equivocated. I don't know. What does this tell us about what's happening here?
Yeah, I would. It's a great study by Tricia Bruce, who is a postdoc there, and it was a long interview style study where she interviewed about 200 people about abortion, and these are long conversations, like 45 minutes to an hour conversations, and she would begin by asking them basic questions about how they felt about abortion in various scenarios under various circumstances. And then she would ask them the same questions near the end of the interview, exact same questions, and they would give totally opposite answers to the same questions at the end than they did at the beginning. And she would even point that out to some of them, right? Like, do you realize you're contradicting yourself? And they would laugh like, yeah, I know. I know I'm contradicting myself, but I just don't have very like sort of clear, bright, strong opinions about abortion. I'm actually sort of very pragmatic and practical and sort of compromising and seeing both sides. And the more you nudge me one direction or the other, the more my opinion would change on this issue. And you know, the upshot of that is very few Americans sort of hold black and white views on abortion. Yeah. You know, where they think, oh, abortion is absolutely murder. Sperm plus egg equal human. We got to stop it always. Or on the other side, side, it's like, no, abortion is not even a moral negative thing. Like, it's just fine. It's just part of life. We should be proud of having abortions. It's just part of medical care. Very few people agree with that as well. And fortunately, those two sides are the ones who get all the play on national media when the average American tends to sort of be like, I don't think it should be like willy-nilly, but I also don't think it should be illegal either. So most Americans don't sit around and think about abortion with this sort of holistic worldview that we would think that when we talk about it, when the people like priests and pastors and politicians talk about it, they have this very sort of like thoughtful understanding of abortion. Most Americans are more concerned with like putting gas in their car and making sure their kids, you know, stay on the straight and narrow at school than they are about, you know, when life begins and at what gestational age should we allow abortion or not.
Is the share of Americans who are religious continues to go on this decline. Who's going to be left going to church? I mean, one of the things you mentioned is that religious people are going to be just more and more committed to their faith than ever. And you use this analogy of like when you make a really good pan sauce, that it will just continue to get reduced and reduced and reduced. And so in the end, it's this, I guess, this concentration of these really strident believers.
That's my biggest worry of all, is it's the true believers that are left over in these churches, synagogues, mosques, you know, houses of worship across America. In college, we read this textbook that talked about doubt. Yeah. And it said, doubt gives us a sober second thought on actions and beliefs. And I thought, man, that's a good definition of what religion needs to have. And if you have a bunch of people in the room who don't doubt, you got no sober second thoughts. You got no one saying, hey, man, maybe that's a bad idea to say that or believe that or go down that road. And the problem is, as you continue to purify that sort of devil's advocate person, that person is sort of like, say, whoa, hold on, let's think this thing through. Or maybe that's not exactly right. Or maybe the Bible doesn't actually say that. Those kind of people are going to give way to groupthink in a way that we've never seen before. And what's going to happen is people are going to continue to spiral to the left and right without any sort of governors or handbrakes or hesitation, because they don't have those doubts. That, to me, a good community of faith has those people who are always saying, but what about this and what about that? And maybe we should think about this. And as we go forward and those sort of that reduction sauce continues to reduce, those are the kind of people who are going to leave out, because why would they stick around and be ridiculed and mocked for even having doubts? Because the people that are left in the room don't have any doubts. And to me, I mean, that's where religion can lead into anti-democratic, little d-democratic views and actions and behaviors, and lead to violence and bloodshed and genocide. Like, I mean, the religion, if directed in the proper direction, can be, you know, life-changing, can be liberating, can be community-building. But religion at its worst can be nothing except power and money and destruction and death. Doubt is the thing that tempers those things, that steers us one direction or the other. And I worry that the future is going to be a doubtless faith in America, which I don't think is what we were designed to have or be.
Let's come back to something you said earlier, you mentioned in the book. If current trends continue, these mainline churches that are more in that sort of gray area of belief and doubt and all of those things, that those churches will be mostly extinct in 20 to 30 years. And so I wonder, will this happen, do you think, or will this only happen unless things change? It's kind of like the Ghost of Christmas Future, you know, and A Christmas Carol. Mm-hmm. Is this going to happen, or if something changes, if there's some alteration or some rethinking, that you could actually salvage that middle?
I mean, I try to be hopeful. The key word there is try to be hopeful. But I mean, I think that we're sort of, the die has been cast in many ways. I mean, I wrote the book with the hopes that a lot of people like me, who are certainly inclined towards faith but haven't gone to church in a long time, would have said, you know what? Ryan makes a good argument here. I should probably, you know, get up on Sunday morning, get out of my bed and get dressed and go to church and try a couple out and see if I can find one that I like and likes me. And if we, you know, if enough people did that, we'd have critical mass. But I think the problem is we have a you go first problem. You know, like, oh, you go tell me if it's a good church or not, a place that I would find, you know, helpful and welcoming and all those things. And if you go for a while and find out it's good, then I'll go. And then the other person goes, no, you go first. You be the guinea pig. And if we all sort of like win at the same time, I think it would have this like sort of amazing effect of like, man, show, how cool would it be for you to go to a church that's been really kind of holding steady at 100, 125 people for, you know, a couple years. And then one day you show up, it's got 12 new people you've never seen before. who are willing to come and be committed to the church for a while and see what they've got. Like, think about the feeling that changes in a situation like that. But barring that, which I think is unlikely, I mean, hopeful, but I'm unlikely that that's going to happen. Barring that, I think we're headed to a future where, you know, those churches are very purified, very one note. You know, we're talking churches where 90% of people voted for the same candidate. I think that's a bad situation, whether it be the Republican or the Democrat. And I think that's very much happening. That's already happened in large swaths of America right now, and will continue to happen in large swaths of America. And I think it's, man, I just don't think that's the America that I want to be a part of, that I want to live in. I look for an America with diversity of thought and belief and behavior and race and gender and age and socioeconomic status. And yet, unfortunately, there's no place in American life outside the, you know, a few churches here and there where we can get those kind of things.
Well, I guess this sort of leads us to something I wanted to ask you about finally, because this is your own experience. You had to make this decision about whether on a Sunday to get up and go, because you write this, you know, sort of beautiful story about your final worship service. This was in July of 2024, because you had to close the First Baptist Church that you had been a pastor of. The numbers just didn't work out anymore. And you write about that final worship session and how emotional you were and how you thought about it. And then you took two Sundays off. And then came the third Sunday, and you write about how you thought it would, how easy it would be to just sort of stay in bed, you know, mm-hmm. not get dressed. Will you just sort of talk about the decision that you finally make?
I'm a big believer that you've sort of got to take your own medicine. I try to practice what I preach. And when I keep telling people over and over again that going to church is good for you, but then I choose to not go to church, like, what am I? It's like a doctor who keeps telling you, like, cut your sugar out, but it's like eating handfuls of potato chips all the time. You know, would you trust that person? So for me, it was, I know the value of being part of a community of faith, and I need that as part of my life. And so, yeah, I did took two Sundays off to sort of like clear the decks, I guess. And that was weird, because that's not something I was used to. I mean, my entire life, I did not go to church on Sunday morning. And then I had a couple of people who had reached out to me and invited me to a couple of different worship services. So I went to two different churches that sort of I liked but didn't like for certain reasons. And then one of our good friends, they were a member of the United Methodist Church. And they said, would you like to come to church with us this Sunday? I said, I would love to do that, because I want someone to sit with. I don't want to be the weirdo sitting by myself. And so I sat with them. And I've been going to that church with a good level of consistency. I will say I'm not as faithful as I was when I was a pastor. I don't go every single Sunday. I mean, my kid has travel baseball, and I have traveling for speaking events and things like that. So I miss Sundays. But I try. In my head, I say I can miss about four times a year just sort of like on my own volition. You know, just like I don't want to go to church today for whatever reason. I got too much work, or my mind's not in the right place. But I really try to limit myself to missing for like my own reasons about four times a year. So I probably end up going to church 35 Sundays a year, maybe 40 Sundays a year, which feels just about right. And what's interesting about that story is that half of my church members go to that same church now from First Baptist. They go to the First United Methodist Church. And actually on Sunday, there were five of them there outside of me. So over half the church are going to the United Methodist Church, and they all sit together in the same row. And it's honestly really great, because it's like whatever we had from First Baptist is not dead. It's actually carried over just to a new form of worship in a new church a little bit down the road.
Well, I mean, so that's the hopeful part. You go into church, you did get up, you got dressed, you went, you know, and because you say you've never been more hopeful but also more afraid. So it's so interesting to see. I guess you're having to work out both of those conflicting impulses all the time, hoping that it works and just feeling nervous about it all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mother Teresa was asked, like, how do you change the world? She goes, the only thing you can do to change the world is go home and love your family. And I think about that all the time. And I also heard a Catholic priest one time said, everyone wants to change the world, but no one wants to go home and do the dishes. And I think like those two ideas in my head like have made me realize that like I can write about all these big sweeping macro level deals about America and the church and society and democracy, which is all big and important. But at the end of the day, the only thing I can control is what I can control, which is my life and my family. So, you know, me being part of an active church community and willing to like do the hard work. You know, I'm on the board of my kid's school district. I'm on the board of what's called the Rec Center, which is like the sort of like public pool we have in the community that's supported by members. I mean, I help like paint the pool. I know that that's what's good for me, for my soul, and for my community. Like, I do believe that I can only control what I can control. And if I believe that being pro-social, being a good neighbor and a good friend and a good citizen of my community, if I say that to be true but don't actually do it, then I am the worst of the worst. So I've got to actually put my money where my mouth is. And that's what I've realized. I go home and love my family and do the dishes, do the hard work of what it takes to build community. And I think we have a pretty good community because a lot of people have the same mentality I do. And I think that's what I'm blessed by, is seeing these selfless people who are willing to work and give and other time and money to make the world a better place in our community. And if that changes the world, that'll change the world in the aggregate, not because we've actually made a big swing, but a whole bunch of small swings, you know, like the pool and like the school board and like my church. If I can do that, be a good father and a good husband, then I've done my job.
Ryan Burge, thank you very much.
This has been awesome, man. I really appreciate being here.
Ryan Burge, he's a professor of practice at the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University. His book is The Vanishing Church: How the Hollowing Out of Moderate Congregations is Hurting Democracy, Faith, and Us. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West, on YouTube at KUER 90.1. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida. The program is produced by Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.